Hi, this is Austin Alexander, Vice President of Sustainability and Social Impact at Xylem, and you're listening to the Water Values Podcast.
The Water Values Podcast is sponsored by the following market-leading companies and organizations: by the American Water Works Association, dedicated to the world's most important resource; by Black & Veatch, building a world of difference; by 120 Water, new rules need new tools; by Advanced Drainage Systems, our reason is water; by 1898 & Co., possibilities powered by experience; by Woodard & Curran, high-quality consulting engineering, science, and operation services; by Intera, innovation and stewardship for a sustainable tomorrow; and by Xylem, let's solve water. This is Session 267.
Welcome to the Water Values Podcast. This is the podcast dedicated to water utilities, resources, treatment, reuse, and all things water. Now here's your host, Dave McGimsey.
Hello and welcome to another session of the Water Values Podcast. As my daughter Sarah said, my name is Dave McGimsey, and thank you for joining me, and thank you for your support over the last 10 plus years. Today we have a fantastic guest. We have Isaac Pellerin, the Vice President of Marketing for 120 Water. And Isaac is going to provide you a snapshot of some data on the lead service line inventories that were recently due under the lead and copper rule revisions. And then Isaac's going to go on and discuss the lead copper rule improvements that were issued last month and what some of the important things utilities need to be aware of are. Plus, Reese Tisdale is here for a Bluefield on Tap segment that's going to update us on spending under the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. Well, as you know, we always say thank you to our awesome sponsors at the top of every show. And we have fantastic sponsors this year. Our sponsorship lineup includes the American Water Works Association, Black & Veatch, 120 Water, Advanced Drainage Systems, 1898 & Co., Woodard & Curran, Intera, and Xylem. And that, as I'm sure you well know, is a terrific collection of impactful companies that have affirmatively decided to support water industry thought leadership and education. And I thank you all. And I'd like for you, please, the listener, to do me a favor. If you work for or with any of those sponsors, please thank your boss or thank your contact at the sponsor firm and let them know that you appreciate their leadership in the industry through the sponsorship. You'd be surprised how far that simple little note of thanks will go. And as long as you're letting the sponsors know you appreciate their support of water industry education thought leadership, hey, why not leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or whatever other podcast directory you're accessing the podcast on? It'd be greatly appreciated and will help others find out about the podcast. And also, please don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. Well, before we head on to the interview with Isaac Pellerin, we've got a Bluefield on Tap segment with Bluefield Research's Reese Tisdale. So take it away, guys. Well, Reese, welcome to another Bluefield on Tap. How are you doing this month?
I am pretty good. I'm just going to say this. I'm a transplant, as everybody knows. The Yankees, up until this morning, were down 3-0, almost swept. So that was going to make me feel good. We often talk baseball, but yeah. You know, when your team is really terrible and you've given up altogether on the Boston Red Sox, there's nothing better as a Boston fan to see the Yankees almost getting swept.
Oh, that's good. That's good. So, as always, there is a lot going on in the water sector. So what's at the top of the heap this month?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. There's, and I think actually one of your guests on this pod is going to be interesting as well, talking about lead and copper rule. In this case, one thing that's come up on the Bluefield agenda is the status of the Infrastructure Investment Jobs Act. You know, every, I'd say, 6 or 7 months, we go through project lists and we try to figure out of the, you know, we started with, as far as our measurements go, looking at approximately $51 billion of appropriations to everything from lead service line replacement to emerging contaminants, water recycling reuse through state revolving funds, the Bureau of Reclamation. And we've got an update. So of those, I think the numbers that we really look at, we sort of narrow it in on about $43 billion of appropriations. So little bit of an update happening. So I can give you a heads up and the listeners what's happening.
Yeah, I'm interested to hear this because I think the last time we talked about this, the contractors were kind of standing around saying, hey, where's the money? And so has there been any movement towards that, towards actually getting shovels into the ground?
It's starting to move a little bit. It's still incrementally. So when we sort of, just to keep it simple, the way we look at it is we look at it kind of in a, you want to call it a chronological order. We look at one appropriation. So we're looking at $43.5 billion appropriated. Then the next step is how much of that has been allotted to the states. We're looking at about $23 billion, slightly over. And then the next step is we look at obligations. Now we're really starting to look at, okay, what's been obligated? What is actually going to these projects? We're looking at $15 billion. And then there's a subset of that, or it's called subawards, and that's about $3.3 billion. So, you know, and this is just within the state revolving funds, just to be clear. So we're looking at about 8% of state revolving funds that have been appropriated have been granted to the recipient. So we're still at a pretty low level at this point. I suspect, given what's happened over the past couple months, we're in October, things will start picking up pretty soon.
Yeah. And so what are the buckets that those projects are falling into? Is it, you know, just, you know, treatment plan improvements? Is it lead and copper rule compliance? You know, what kind of buckets are we talking about here?
Yeah. So, I mean, generally, the big chunks are going to be is state revolving fund. So let's just start with that. That's 85% of the funding. But the buckets within that are the drinking water state revolving fund and the clean water state revolving fund. So those are the two next level buckets. And to your point, more specifically, lead and copper represents about, I think that's $15 billion. Emerging contaminants is another $10 billion. And so then thereafter, you start getting into smaller smaller appropriations where you start getting into things like WIFIA and such. But that's really the big chunk. I think one thing that's worth pointing out, you know, when you look at the lead piece of the puzzle, we're looking at about 54% of these funds, at least for lead, have been awarded to states. You know, and that's for things like inventorying and less on the replacement at this level. I mean, we're just getting to figuring out what the problem is.
So what do you see as next steps? What's coming after? Because as you know, these mind-boggling numbers are just scratching the surface for what the scope of the problem is with the lead and copper rule improvements and the replacements that are going to need to be taking place and the PFAS and the emerging contaminants removal and just the state of infrastructure that is so aged and old. The need is incredible. So there's obviously a funding gap. What's the next step that you see?
Yeah, I think this is definitely worth, you know, keeping in mind, right? Mind-boggling, yes, these numbers are. So when you look at Infrastructure Investment Jobs Act, you know, just new funding to water is about $55 billion from the federal government. But this is a one-off. And I think longer term, the bigger issue is, you know, how do we continue to deal with lead? So we've appropriated $15 billion. Well, actually, the EPA has stated the problem may be as high as $90 billion to address. Funding gap right there. Pretty obvious. So there's going to have to be funds coming from somewhere else. PFAS, we've talked about, as I mentioned, $10 billion appropriated for emerging contaminants. We see numbers as high as for water and wastewater numbers hitting as high as $250 billion to address that. So how is that going to be paid for? So this is all great, and I think the water sector is excited. There are lots of opportunities with these funds. I think, you know, long term, though, the problem is actually multiples greater than this, and that it's going to take some creative financing, whether it come from the federal government, the state and local governments, or the private sector to some extent, and probably a combination of all of the above.
Interesting times we live in. Well, Reese, today was election day, so Get out and vote, everyone. And it's always good talking with you. Thanks for dropping the knowledge, and we'll talk again soon. Thanks so much, Reese.
All right, Dave. Appreciate it. Look forward to talking soon.
Bye. As always, great information from Bluefield Research and Reese Tisdale. Now it's time for the main event, our interview with Isaac Pellerin, the Vice President of Marketing for 120 Water. So let's get that water flowing. Well, Isaac, welcome to the Water Values Podcast. Great to have you on. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me, Damon.
Yeah, it's going to be great. You know, this is such an important topic that we're going to hit on today, the lead and copper rule improvements. But before we get to that, I'd like for you to share a little about your background and how you came to the water sector.
Yeah, happy to give you my background. So I've long had a passion for doing community development and then technology companies. So I've worked in technology companies since 2009, working in the sales and marketing technology sector, where we brought solutions to market for VPs of sales, VPs of marketing, tools that really help them in their lives. Before that, I worked in community development at a church in a small community that was looking for, that was really looking to rebuild. And in 2009, I joined a company called Compendium, and Megan Glover, who's the CEO of 120 Water, was my first boss in the technology sector, and really taught me a lot about what it means to build a team and a technology company. So when she started 120 Water in 2016, we were grabbing coffee, and I asked her when it was ready. I would love to join 120 Water and learn more about the water sector. And so when that happened, it really, for me, blended what I loved about working in community development and working with people, and what I loved about working with technology. And I remember going to my very first rural water utility conference and meeting water operators. And what stuck out to me was they didn't have big egos. They were public servants, and they cared so much about their place that it left me with a sense that if I'm building technology, if I'm building software, these are the folks I want to build technology for and learn more about their problems and how technology can help them digitize the things that they do so that they can impact their communities.
Yeah, what a great response. And I completely agree with you. That's what I love about the water sector, is that people are down to earth, or the, you know, salt of the earth types of folks. And they are interested not in petty issues. They are really there to serve the community. So I think we're aligned on that. So I've had Megan Glover on before, and the business model has changed dramatically. Can you speak to a little bit about how the business model for 120 Water has changed over the years?
Yeah, absolutely. So when Megan started 120 Water, it was really in the aftermath of the Flint crisis. And as from a consumer standpoint, saying, hey, how would a consumer understand what's in my water? And so she connected with a co-founder and someone who owned a lab, who also became a co-founder, to develop a consumer-facing water sampling kit. So the idea was someone could come to the website. You could still do this today and order a sample kit for $52, $59, and that would get sent to your address. You would fill it. It would be drop shipped to a EPA-approved lab, and then you would get the results. So a consumer could get that transparency of what's in the water. And then shortly after that, there was just more opportunities where the state of Indiana was wanting to develop a program to sample in schools and daycares. That was statewide. And they reached out to 120 Water to see if the technology and kits could be used for that purpose. So that was where Megan started looking at, hey, how can we build software that serves this segment of the market? And then also there were a handful of utilities who were wanting to offer customer sampling programs. So to build a way for a resident to request that their water be sampled by the utility, but have that be outsourced to 120. to reduce administrative burden. And so in both cases, it kind of developed from a consumer facing to, hey, we can build a platform for utilities to help them run the programs. And building that meant looking at, hey, where's your data? And realizing that there was an opportunity to break down some of the data silos that exist and bring together asset data with customer data so that there could be more communication. And so that really started the development of our platform that we built for managing water quality programs and facilities with the lead sampling in daycares and schools. And then our platform to help utilities manage water quality programs that they run. And then a few years ago when the LCRR was introduced, we started looking at how can we serve state regulators and state SRF managers with a platform to allow for submissions of all these service line inventories. And so it kind of evolved from direct to consumer to a platform for utilities and folks managing many facilities to serving the state agency. And it's just been really exciting to see how that trajectory has allowed for more communication between utilities and regulators and then more transparency with the public.
Yeah, that's a great outcome. Absolutely great outcome. Well, you mentioned the LCRR that was promulgated in, I think it was the final rule in 21. So what is, and I think most folks in the water industry at least know that lead service line inventories were due recently. So kind of, can you kind of give us a flavor for what the state of the utility inventory submissions is?
Yes, absolutely. So it's been definitely a lot has happened in the past couple of years after the lead and copper rule revisions were released. So initially we did a lot of education with, we partnered a lot with a lot of associations and the National Rural Water Association to really provide education on what's required. And the first thing that you mentioned was that service line inventory. So every utility in the United States had to submit a service line inventory by October 16th to their primacy agency. And when you think about that, that means that there's a lot of data coming in, a lot of spreadsheets being submitted of these inventories to state agencies, and that can get quite complex to process that much data. The idea behind this was, we do not know where all of the lead is. This is one of the legislations. One of the goals of this was to provide the inventory where a lot of utilities might know the material of the service line, the pipe that goes from the main to the house, that's on their property, that's on public property. But once it's on private property, that's largely could be an unknown. And so not knowing that material proposed a health risk and trying to understand, hey, what's the best way to inventory that? So by October 16th, every utility had to submit an initial service line inventory, which meant it could include the notion that it's an unknown line, and that's okay. Between then and then, what that does is that kind of draws a line in the sand and says, okay, now we're on a journey to say, how many unknown lines does a utility have? What's their path to verifying and discovering what that material type is? And when there is lead, what's the path to replacing that lead? And so so that was really the idea behind LCRR, was get ready to submit an inventory. And that was a pretty big lift for a lot of utilities across the country. As I mentioned, because we had a number of platforms that serve both state agencies, primacy agencies, and utilities, we saw growth in our platform where we're serving just about 8,000 utilities have access to our platform to submit those inventories, which gave us a lot of insight into what the state of the market looks like. So just kind of the high level stats, what we saw was about just under 15 million service lines were submitted to the inventory process. And As I mentioned, the idea of unknowns and lead and galvanized that might require replacement across all those utilities, 8,000, about 65%, 35% are unknown, and about 2% are lead and 1% are galvanized requiring replacement. So that really kind of paints a picture that there's a lot of work to do to address that 35% over the next couple of years, to turn those unknowns into known. Additionally, one of the things that I've been looking at is when we look at rural water or rural populations, so populations that serve less than 10,000 folks, that number of unknowns is closer to 47%, which really kind of speaks to the need for funding to address smaller communities. And then what we saw in systems of larger populations is that they're more known, but that also means that they're more led. So I'm kind of hypothesizing that larger systems have more data at their disposal to really get started on replacing those lead pipes because they know where they are.
Yeah. The very interesting analysis of that the urban areas have a higher percentage of known, but also that means a higher percentage of lead in the rural areas are probably. So is it speculation then that the urban areas are going to get kind of the bulk of the funds that are coming from the feds up front? Now, granted, the feds aren't going to pay for everything, right? So, but they're,
yeah.
So the urban areas are probably going to be the first to change out the lead lines, and then closer to the 10-year limit. We'll get into that 10-year limit in a minute here, but the rural areas will probably be bringing up the rear, so to speak, on lead service line replacements.
Yeah, I like to think that with the data, it allows primacy agencies and state revolving loan fund agencies to have a conversation about the diversity of programs that might be needed in deploying the funds from the Bipartisan Infrastructure Act, knowing that, hey, some of the needs might be to work on verification programs of identifying the lead, and then some of those funds can go directly to accelerating and starting for those that have a fully known known system. So I like, I think at its best, it allows us to make sure that we are solving a diversity of problems for systems of all sizes and accounting for the fact that they might be nuanced. I always like to talk about, you know, this idea that for in the United States, there's about, 55,000 utilities, but 93% of those utilities serve populations of 10,000 or less, and 85% of utilities operate with three or fewer employees. And so the a lot of the work needs to be done to create partnerships and partner with those on the rural side, with the rural water utility associations in that effort to kind of shore up the people capacity to do that discovery of what the line material is. And then on the larger utility side, they have to be able to look at the populations within that area that say, hey, these are underserved populations. This is where the money should go to ensure that there's the least amount of investment needed on behalf of the resident to solve this problem.
Got it. So we're kind of bleeding into the LCRI. So the lead copper rule improvement, which was recently published. Can you talk a little about how that builds on what the lead copper rule revisions did?
Yeah. So when the EPA released the lead and copper rule revisions, it definitely established that inventory is due October 16th. It also established that within 30 days of October 16th, they would have to issue notifications to residents about what is known or what is unknown. So do you have a lead line, a galvanizer, an unknown? But they also said that there was going to be some clarification to the lead and copper rule revisions, which is the lead and copper rule improvements. So those were finalized 1 week before October 16th. So I believe it was on October 9th or so is when they were released. And that provided some clarity that the industry was needing. So for instance, they said that those lead pipes have to be replaced in 10 years. Now, it's important to keep in mind that because it was released in 2024, it goes into effect in 2027. So that timeline really starts from 2027 through the end of 2037. That is where that 10-year mark really starts kicking in. It also established that lead service lines inventories must be publicly available if you're serving a population of 50,000 or more, and it's a best practice to make sure it's publicly available in an interactive website for populations that serve less than 50,000. They also lowered the lead action level from 15 to 10, which they had a notion before of having two numbers, like and so making it one number makes it a bit less confusing on behalf of the public. But it does mean that in future sampling, lead and copper sampling events that utilities do, that there's a high likelihood that they may hit that 90th percentile. And then they also introduced a new sampling protocol where you're not just taking the first liter of the sample, but you're taking a first liter and a fifth liter, and whichever of those is highest is what needs to be is the result that needs to play into your percentile calculation. And then there are just strength and protection to reduce lead exposure overall in terms of education, and utilities will need to start sampling in schools and daycares starting in 2027. They have to do 20% of their school and daycares each year for 5 years.
Okay, that's a fantastic summary. Now, I got a couple questions before we kind of move on to kind of what all this stuff means and what's, you know, was there anything surprising? First off, you mentioned the first and fifth liter sampling. What's the impact of there? Why is that important to understand? Like, what's the significance of the first liter and what's the significance of the fifth liter of the sample?
Yeah, so the first liter typically, through different studies, was saying that, hey, that first liter sample is really identifying the water that's within potentially the on-premise plumbing, so within the house or the structure. So to really get to the water that's in the service line after it has settled, taking that fifth liter ensures that we're getting a full sample of water that's both inside the house when you take that sample and out further in the pipe to ensure that you have a representative sample. The impact of that is up until now, utilities have always looked at that first liter sample. And so it introduces an element of unknown where even if in the past they were under the 15 parts per million threshold, they will now be, now that that's dropped to 10, their next sampling event could put them in an action level exceedance, meaning they would have to do a corrosion control study and their lead service line replacement plan would kick in and they would have to start replacing pipes and reducing unknowns. So the impact is it introduces an element of unknown and it does kick in actions that a utility might need to be prepared to take that's where it becomes really important to have your data organized in a way to be able to take those actions quickly.
Got it. Got it. So let's say I think you hit on this a little bit, but the sample hits the new 0.010 milligrams per liter.
Mm-hmm.
What does that trigger? What is the response? Should you hit that lead action level?
Yeah. So if you hit that lead action level, then you need to notify. You need to send out notifications again, notifying the community that you've been that you're in action level exceedance, that you have an action level exceedance, and you have to start your lead service line replacement plan, replacing 3% of your lines each year. And this is where one of the impacts of that is your calculation of how many lines you need to replace incorporates your unknowns. So if you submitted an inventory with all unknowns, then you have a lot of work to do because you immediately have to start identifying if those unknowns are lead and immediately start replacing. So for those who have more known, then they're in more control of understanding the scope of the problem that they have to solve.
Very good. So the LCRI was, you know, as you mentioned, published early in October. What kind of stood out for you as a surprise that utilities should be aware of?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest surprises is around this idea of emerging verification, emerging methods. So the LCRI top, you know, they've been a lot of progress made on things like predictive modeling or using different verification methods. So one of the things that they talked about in there was that if you use a verification method that is emerging, they want you to take a subset of that and actually dig holes, get eyes on the pipe to verify that whatever method you used, if it wasn't actually getting eyes on the pipe, gives them confidence that all the due diligence was done. So I think that's one of those things where for as much as we want to have easy buttons, the EPA really kind of said, hey, you can use emerging methods. We just want additional, a subset of that emerging method that you use to have eyes on the pipe to really do that additional layer of verification. So though I think there's always been this a little bit of a game of like, hey, how do you use new technology to reduce work, but how do you also improve confidence in the method that you used? And so I think there was some hope that we could say, hey, we used this method and carte blanche says that we don't have lead. And the EPA basically saying, cool, but we want you to do some additional verification if that's a method that you used. And so I think that's something that utilities should be aware of.
Yeah. Is what you described there potholing, what's commonly termed as potholing? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Potholing or visual inspection could also be if they could pop a lid and see the meter and see both sides of that, then that might be a way, but it really just depends on the community if that's the way their meters were installed.
Yeah. The engineers I'm around love to use the word potholing. So,
yeah. Yeah. And potholing is expensive. You know, like it's one of those things, like from an economic standpoint, it can cost like, you know, $700 per hole versus, you know, pennies on the dollar if you can if you did your records review and can they could just go through and identify with a model that you don't have lead. So it can be I get the incentive for methods that are less costly. And so I feel like there was a bit of a meet in the middle there.
Got it. Got it. So I'm a utility and I understand I've got my lead service line inventory turned in. I'm reading the lead copper rule improvements. What should I be thinking of next? What are kind of the things I got to think of on my to-do list next?
Yeah. So the very next thing, as I mentioned, was the sending notifications. So in a lot of states, they're sending letters directly to any resident with a lead, galvanized, or unknown service line. So that has an impact on what your community is going to be hearing from you. So I think one, you need to get those notifications out. Two, you need to think about how to engage the public, the residents, in your effort to turn unknowns into knowns. So there's a lot of folks that are kicking off campaigns to say, hey, if it's an unknown line, here's how you can come to our utilities website. Here's instructions on how to take a picture of the line if you have access to it in the basement, or give us permission, fill out a form, give us permission to do an investigation in your home. So that's one thing, is we need to think about not just sending out the notifications, but the impact that that has on public perception and really the opportunity that offers to engage the public in the process. Because as we know, since half the line is on private property, we need to get permission to eventually replace that line. So I think it lays that out. There are utilities who are also, we see a lot of our customers doing this, and they're sending out the notifications, is creating programs for offering sampling, whether the utility pays for it or it's just offered so that the resident knows how to get their water sampled, and or in conjunction with a pitcher filter program as an intermediate solution until the pipe can be prioritized for replacement. So those are the next actions are get the notifications out, use that as an opportunity to get consent and inform the public on the actions that they can take, and then really kick off. You know, we have between now and 2027 before the next inventory is due to reduce as many unknowns as possible. So getting on a verification planning track to say, hey, if we don't know what the pipe is, let's get on a program to figure that out. Because the fewer unknowns you have by 2027, the more that will have a significant fiscal impact on the actions you need to take in replacement efforts moving forward. And so the other piece, and I failed to mention this earlier, but that the next inventory also has to have the connector if a connector is present. So so that can be like a 18-inch foot length of pipe that goes from the main to the service line, sometimes referred to as a pigtail or a gooseneck pipe. That could have been lead and could have an impact on the classification.
Those are great points. I would just encourage also utilities, this is a golden opportunity for you to build trust with your constituents, with your customers. So don't waste that opportunity, because you're going to need to communicate with them anyway on this stuff. So take a full advantage of the opportunity to communicate with your customers.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the cool things that I see happening is the number of folks that are setting up interactive websites to allow a customer to search for their address and see what that offers. Again, as I said, that's required for utilities that serve populations of more than 50,000. But what we see even in utilities that serve less than that is that that has a significant impact, one, on building trust, because you're making it accessible, easy, and you're not making it complicated to get the information. But it also can have an impact on reducing administrative burden, so because you're making it easy to get access to that information. So inbound calls to your utility saying, hey, I just got this letter. What does it mean? How do I find out more? You can direct people quickly to where they can get that information, and that can reduce administrative burden on utilities, which is important when we're when many utility staffs are stretched pretty thin.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, Isaac, you've been absolutely terrific. I've really thought that you've hit all the points in the LCRI. You know, granted, the rule's what, 860 pages or something like that.
Yeah, there's a lot in there.
Yeah,
and we have But yeah, there's so much to dig into there.
Yeah, you've distilled it down perfectly. So thank you so much for coming on. Do you have a leave behind message that you'd like to leave the listeners with?
Yeah, again, I think, you know, anything that we can do to help data agencies or utilities to really strategize on those next steps, that's what we're here for. We're open to those, the ways that we partner alongside me to manage either high volumes of data, come up with strategies on verification, or really looking at what's next in your line copper compliance journey. So you can always visit 140water.com to learn more and spend time with our specialists. And yeah, I can't thank you enough for this opportunity and just this, it's a once in a generation investment that we're making in our infrastructure. And I'm really excited that we get to be part of it.
Awesome. Isaac, you've been absolutely fantastic. I would ask you to identify where those who can, who want to learn more about you and 120 Water go to get that information, but you identified the site. It's www.120water. That's 120water.com.
That's correct.
Awesome. Isaac, thanks so much. You've been fantastic. Really appreciate it. And we'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you.
All right. Bye now. Bye. Fantastic information drop there by Isaac. And so important for utilities to understand the regulatory landscape they're now facing under the LCRI. Again, that's the Lead Copper Rural Improvements. Hope you were taking notes when Isaac was speaking. And thanks again, Isaac, for your time and for providing us with such valuable knowledge and insights into the Lead and Copper Rural Improvements, as well as the Lead Copper Rule revisions in the service line, lead service line inventories that were recently due. Well, I'd love to know what you thought about the interview. Please check out the show notes page for information and links on this episode. Just Google the Water Values Podcast and click the first link that comes up. That's our home on the web provided by Bluefield Research. As longtime listeners know, Bluefield Research and the Water Values LLC are not affiliates. We just have a joint marketing arrangement. And as part of that, the Water Values gets a home on the web at Bluefield's site. You can email me at david.mcgimsey@dentons.com, and you can sign up for the newsletter at that aforementioned landing page as well. Well, thank you again for tuning in, and I hope you make it a great day. Plus, I want to give a huge thank you to our sponsors. Again, sponsors of the Water Values Podcast include the American Water Works Association, Black & Veatch, 120 Water, Advanced Drainage Systems, 1898 & Co., Woodard & Curran, Intera, and Xylem. This show would not be possible without those great companies and industry leaders. And again, thank you for listening and for subscribing to the Water Values Podcast. Your support is truly appreciated. In closing, please remember to keep the core message of the Water Values Podcast in mind as you go about your daily business. Water is our most valuable resource, so please join me by going out into the world and acting like it.
Listening to the Water Values Podcast. Thank you for spending some of your day with my dad and me.
Well, thank you for tuning in to the disclaimer. I'm a lawyer licensed in Indiana and Colorado, and nothing in this podcast should be taken as providing legal advice or as establishing an attorney-client relationship with you or with anyone else. Additionally, nothing in this podcast should be considered a solicitation for professional employment. I'm just a lawyer that finds water issues interesting and that believes greater public education is needed about water issues. And that includes enhancing my own education about water issues because no one knows everything about water.